Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Financial, now the Financial 50. We're rebranding it because, let's face it, we can't keep it to 15.
We've given up.
Yeah, we've given up on that pipe dream.
Okay.
all right, so this is the podcast where we're going to try to answer your financial questions in 50 minutes or less. Now, I'm your host, Ashley Nichols, and as always, I'm here with our senior portfolio manager and senior wealth advisor, Stephen Biddle.
Hello.
And we're also graced again with Sean Harding. Hello, Sean. It's nice to see you again.
Hello, hello.
Now, we're going to continue our journey through the world of financial planning, and today we're going to be focusing more on the investment side when it comes to your financial plan. So before we get into it, I just want to remind everybody, we record these episodes on a monthly basis. You can hear them all on our website, and that's at www.biddlejohnstonwmteam.ca. It's going to be under the newsletters, podcasts, and videos tab. And you can send any questions, comments, or maybe what we should be covering next to my email, and that's at ashley.nichols@nbpcd.com. And if you have any questions about financial planning that you might want to ask Sean, you can send me those as well. I'm more than happy to send them along. Now, in our last episode, we covered interest rates, how they can help us, how they can hurt us. We touched on the first home savings plan that's been rolled out and how goal planning can work within your plan. So today we're going to explore more on how investments make an impact on our plans and the importance of having your financial planner and your investment professional maybe talking to each other or at least being able to share information between each other. So this is going to be a Stephen and Sean heavy bulk of today episode covering it all. So everyone grab your coffees, get caffeinated because we know that they're going to have lots to talk about. I'm going to fade into the background. So take it away, guys.
Thanks a lot, Ashley. Yeah, so today we thought we want to look at, you know, some concepts that aren't really given that much thought by the average person. Right. And these concepts are incredibly important because it's not just how things work. And Sean's going to address this right away, you know, especially with financial planning. What is one, you know, what's one of the biggest problems with the software out there, Sean?
Single biggest problem is think of a spreadsheet. Think just straight math is when we plug in a rate of return or a rate of inflation for that matter into planning software, it does exactly the same thing year over year over year over year. Until so a typical plan will run 30, 40, 50 years, depending on what age we start you at. And it does that regular rate of return. So if we plug in, for example, the problem isn't with GICs. GICs do exactly that. They do this regular rate of return every year. Where the problem lies is where we're actually working with market-based portfolios, where we're using a rate of return. Hopefully not an average rate of return. We're actually lowballing it. But let's face it, the markets are anything but linear. You're not going to get, you can look at your statement and say, oh, I'm averaging a 6% rate of return over a 10-year period or a 5-year period. That's fantastic, but you're not getting that year over year over year. The financial planning software makes that exact assumption. So right there, that's a flaw. It's an inherent flaw in financial plans that, okay, yeah, sure. At this rate of return, year over year consistently, you're going to be on plan. But what if the markets on the positive side shoot up 10% or 15%? That's fantastic. But the reverse is also true is what if the market suddenly crater 10, 15% for a year or 18 months at a time, that's going to have an impact on the plan. And depending on where you're at in the planning, like at what age you're at, it will have a positive or negative impact.
Yeah, exactly, Sean. What you're talking about is a topic called sequence of returns. And, you know, just as an example, I'm just looking at a little picture beside me, but it's just talking about, you know, on any day, there's a 54% chance the market's up and a 46% chance it's negative. Lots of volatility, right? You take that out to a year, you know, it's kind of like 74% of the time the market's positive, 26 is negative. You know, take it out to 20 years, you're 100%. So, you know, there's volatility. And volatility is fantastic for some people, and it's terrible for others. So the people that it's fantastic for are young investors who are in the accumulation phase. Nothing is better than to watch the market drop at that point because you're putting money into the market. That's huge. On the other side is what we call the distribution phase. That's when you've basically retired and you're taking money out. Big drawdowns are catastrophic in that scenario, right? So just as an example, and I'll, you know, it's lots of numbers, but it gets down to this. There's hypotheticals, but there's three investors, Mrs. Doe, Mr. White, and Mr. Rush. And these three individuals at age 66 retire. They have $1 million and they're going to take out $60,000 a year adjusted for inflation. Now, their returns on their portfolios are identical from a buy and hold perspective. So if you put money in at age 66 and held it to 90, all three portfolios make 7% return. So, you know, linearly thinking, you're like, well, these guys are going to have the same amount of money at the end, right? So an example of Mr. Brown, who has the 7% consistent return, well, he has $430,000 left of his million. Mrs. Doe, she's the lucky one. In the first 3 years that she retires, the market goes up. And because of that initial 3 years, her portfolio ends up being worth actually $99,000 more than when she started. Mr. White, not so good. Mr. White started with two down years. And we're not talking huge. We're just talking -7 and -4. And because of those sequence of returns, he actually runs out of money at 88. So when you think about things, volatility has to be managed, right? So when Sean's talking about using conservative numbers, that's why when you do your plan, you want to use conservative planning numbers, but you also, if possible, want to use conservative withdrawal rates. If you're taking out 8 or 10% out of your portfolio, and if you think about it, right, you know, these are in my head, so don't use your calculator and phone me back and say they're all wrong. But like if you have $100,000 and it drops 20%, and then that's when you take out your 10 grand, well, you've got to go from 70 to 100,000 to get back. That's 40 some odd percent return, right? If it would have dropped 10% and you took out your 10 grand, you don't need as much of return. So you need to reduce the volatility in your portfolios. And that's something so many investors never look at. People always sit there and go, oh, this guy made 10%, this guy made 12, the 12 is better. Well, no, the question is, what is the volatility, right? If you have 10% with a maximum drawdown of, say, 3%, and someone else has 12% with a maximum drawdown of 12, well, one of those portfolios is great for the accumulation side, which is the one with the lots of volatility, but the one with the low drawdown is much better. So if you're ever looking at things, you have to say, you know, what's the drawdown? How is it correlated to the markets, right? Because markets drop. 30% happens, mm-hmm. And it'll happen again. Like they say, you can't guarantee things in the market. Pretty much guarantee you'll have a 30% correction from the peak at some point, right? And the question is does that happen? And your portfolio jumps 30% the year you retire? It's going to be a problem. So always look at the volatility. And the other piece Sean and I were talking about earlier is, you know, some people call it siloing, some people call it bucketing, mm-hmm. But have assets on the side where you don't have to. Like in that year, you need $20,000 for the year and the markets are down 30. Well, if you could take it out of something that's not down, either cash or a GIC or a bond, then it doesn't dig into the portfolio the same way.
Exactly.
So that's a very, very important piece. And I wish people would spend more time thinking about that, right? Because unfortunately, human nature is when the markets have had a good ripper, people think it's going to go on forever, mm-hmm. And they don't worry about risk. And then conversely, when it's down, when you should be looking at buying, they don't have any cash. They don't want to invest because it's going to go down forever, right? And that's a huge source of not only financial strain, but also psychological strain. You know, there's a report that's out there that says when the portfolio drops 25%, most people just throw in the bucket. And they do that, they permanently impair their retirement.
So, and sorry, with us talking a little bit about the problems kind of with the financial planning software, so is there no software available that kind of factors in those kinds of things?
Yeah, so there is. And the software that we use actually has two features that we can use. I don't try to build it in with every single plan that we do because they're complicated concepts. And they can really, you can lose the forest for the trees when you start getting into some of these, I'm gonna say tools that can be built into planning. The first one is called what is known as a Monte Carlo analysis. So what you do is you plug in the an average rate of return, or perhaps on the low side, but then you're also going to plug in the asset mix of the portfolio in there, and it will start taking the standard deviations, commonly accepted standard deviations for the different asset classes. So right there, there's another flaw because they're who's determining what that standard deviation is going to be. So right there, that's a question mark that we have to ask ourselves. But what the Monte Carlo analysis is that it will test your plan with a different sequence of rates of return based on the asset mix and the volatility, so standard deviation. And it will run through that plan something like 500 times, 700 times, and then we'll come back with a percentage of success. How close are you? How much of a buffer is built into the plan? And at what point? So there are some plans that I will run, and it is so down to the wire, just using linear, that when you do the Monte Carlo analysis, it comes back saying you have a 50% chance of success and a 50% chance of failure. Or sometimes there is enough assets that are built up that even when you plug in the standard deviation and they're conservative enough in terms of their portfolio, where the plan comes back 98% chance of success. It'd have to be like there's a 2% chance, and it'd have to be astronomically bad for it to actually fail. So that's one form of analyzing a plan. So, and I have seen people use it. I use it when it's necessary. Right, when the questions really start digging into this, it's like, okay, let's run a Monte Carlo on it and see what it looks like. Second tool that we have is addressing what Stephen was talking about, the sequence. We can say, what if there is a market crash? Let's run the plan, but then let's run in, what if there's a market crash in 2 years? Or what if there's a market crash in 1 year? How does it impact your plan? And you can do a side-by-side comparison, saying if there was a sudden market drop of 10, 12, 15% in the first 2 years, how is it going to impact you? And are you cratering yourself? And there's two ways to address that is one, you reduce the volatility in the portfolio, or two, you'll have to reduce your spending so that you can actually give yourself enough of a buffer to allow for that kind of market downturn and not suddenly find yourself at 88 with no assets, right? Because those are the two real kind of sequences right there. So those are two tools that we do have built into our software. So if we really needed to dig into this topic, we can. We can go into it. It's just not everyone is that interested in seeing it. And sometimes that's not the most relevant of questions right up front. It's, can I retire? Yes. Okay, yes. Okay, let's address that. But let's also look at what Stephen was talking about. What's the mix? How is the portfolio constructed? And I'm no expert in terms of selecting individual securities. That's not my wheelhouse. But we do want to see low volatility income. That would be a good thing.
Yeah, and also when you're speaking about volatility, Sean, is you also need to look at time horizons too, right? Mm-hmm. Which gets back to the goal thing, right? I've had clients say to me, the markets are really good. We've just sold our house and we're going to buy another one in a year. How much do you think we should put in the markets? The answer is zero, right? Because on a one-year return, like when going back to that, it is, maybe it's up, but if that 26% happens and, your 500 grand is now worth 350, well, your house doesn't look quite as good as it used to, no. Right? And then the other side that you can also do, from a return perspective, is GICs are good, right? They give you a return. But what a lot of people forget is you have this thing called a massive reinvestment risk. So what happens if today you put your money in a GIC and get 5% and then rates go back to where they were, which I don't think so. But anyway, theoretically speaking, Okay, now you've just brought everything back and now rates are at 2. So you've just literally lost 60% of the income that your portfolio was generating. So yes, you have a 100% guarantee of principal, but you have a massive reinvestment risk, right? And that, so you want to put it all together. And that's when getting back to that bucketing, right? If you have a short-term goal, put money aside so it won't get affected by the markets and what they're doing, right?
Right.
And like I said, ask your advisor, right, what is the drawdown? Like how much, you know, just literally, how much did the market, how much did your account drop in 2022? How much did your account drop during COVID, right? During COVID, at the worst part in COVID, the S&P was down 33%, and Toronto was down 32%. People got bailed out by the Federal Reserve when they came in and cut rates. But the question is, what happens if they hadn't cut rates? Like, and it stayed like that for a year. Like, could you handle being down 35% of your portfolio? Because that's a legitimate question, right? You know, our portfolios were down 10.5 in general. Let's call it, you know, 10 to 12. We didn't get a lot of people panicking. We'd have people panic and phone up and say, oh my God, how much are we down? We're like, 10. Like, oh my God, I thought we'd bound 30. Well, no, because we control volatility. We raise cash, right? It's much easier to sleep that way. So also, next question I'll throw at you, Sean, we talked about that, is when you look at a return in a portfolio, when you run the numbers, how much does that return have an effect on how you construct the portfolio?
That's really case by case. Say we're building a plan. Generally, we're going to stay near the conservative side of the spectrum anyways. Yep. So clients coming in and saying, I expect nothing less than 10%, I'm going to kind of chuckle at them saying, I can't legally actually even use that number. As a planner, I can't even use that number. It's not going to happen. But I could certainly illustrate it as being a side-by-side comparison. The question is does a client need 4, 5, 5.5, 6 to pull off everything that they want? Then the question then becomes, if we're at the 5 or 6 mark on an average basis, realizing that there's going to be a lot more volatility in a 6% portfolio than in a 4% portfolio, are they comfortable with that kind of volatility, right, to try and give them the lifestyle that they're looking for? Generally, when I'm building a plan, I try to go as try to give them everything that they're looking for with the least amount of return, right? So it's like, well, why shoot for 7 if all you need is 4, right? And unless that's a personal want that you actually want to, you're just naturally inclined to be more aggressive with your portfolio, in which case, then I'd say, okay, well, then we're only going to use the money that you're not going to touch for 10 years because you're voluntarily taking risk that the plan doesn't even show that you need. But yeah, I prefer building plans that have such a conservative rate of return that we're quite confident that we're going to attain it and surpass it, right? Just yep. over time.
Which is good. That's what we look at too, right? You know, I sort of remember, and it, you know, it's kind of hindsight and it worked out great, but I had a client, a very wealthy client, and he had money with me, and he was actually originally from Switzerland, and, you know, we were chatting and he says, this is what I want. And I'm like, well, just leave it in GICs. And his Swiss banker, believe it or not, a real Swiss banker at the time, told him you have to be in the market. And his market portfolio during the 2008 financial crisis lost 50%, right? Our chunk didn't move at all. And, you know, I could easily have said, put it in there, but he didn't need that money. He had more than enough money to live, right? And that's an example where, you know, people get greedy. Go back to the plan. And also the other way around, if you need 4 or 5% over time and your account's down 10% in 1 year, if you've got the 10-year time horizon, you shouldn't need to panic. And also one other thing I think that, you know, when you do financial planning, it calculates this, but a lot of people don't do financial planning in their heads. And what I'm talking about is rates of return are not equal. So a 5% return on a GIC does not equal a 5% capital gain. And it does not equal a 5% dividends, right? And maybe I'll let Sean just chat on that and kind of expand on what I mean by that.
All right. So the different investments all produce different types of return, especially in the taxable accounts, right? So if it's in an RRSP, it's less consequential because the RRSPs are tax sheltered and you're only taxed when you're pulling the money out. In a non-registered portfolio, interest income, so GICs, for example, and some of the bond returns, interest income is taxed the highest. It's just the way our tax system works. The least amount of risk gets taxed the worst, and the more risk you take, the better it is tax-wise. Just seems to be, it's how our system is kind of designed. So the three big ones are interest income, your dividend income, your capital gains. And in capital gains in planning is actually, we look at it two ways. We look at it in terms of capital gains that are crystallized every year, right? Just through portfolio rotation, like you're buying and selling every year, a certain number of your equities. And then there are other capital gains that are just inherently built in. And by that, I mean by virtue of buy and hold. So you're holding the same stock year over year over year over year over year. You can start accumulating a long-term capital gain right into your portfolio that way. So I kind of usually look at the capital gain side of things two ways. Some of it's going to get crystallized every year, and some of it might just inherently start getting built in. You really need very large non-registered portfolios in a strictly buy and hold type scenario for that to occur and become a problem. I have seen it where people acquired large amounts of company stock, right, when they were working. They were purchasing shares, and they never sold them. They just kept them. And then suddenly they're in their 70s, 80s, and we've got this massive capital gain that we have to try and deal with. Doesn't happen very often, but there are those scenarios out there where it's, okay, now we need to do some tax planning around this large amount of stock that's just gone up in value over years, years and years and years. And now we've got this big capital gain built in. So
yeah, and also just to add to that too, Sean, I was just looking, you know, at the Alberta tax, and I think this might floor some people, but when you look at dividends for lower income individuals, it's incredibly beneficial. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the marginal tax rate on dividends for up to $53,000 in Alberta, if that's the only income you had was dividends, is 2.6%. You literally can bring in almost $50,000 a year in dividends in Alberta if you have no other income, and you will almost pay no taxes. Conversely, interest in that area is 25%. So if you're looking at, you know, a 4% dividend on a bank stock versus a 5% GIC, you are literally crushing it after tax by owning the dividends.
Yeah.
Right? And even when you move up to that $53,000 to $106,000 bracket, you know, that marginal rate on interest is basically 30%, dividends is 10, capital gains is 15. So all things are not created equal. So if you have a portfolio that has a mix of stocks, bonds, and capital gains and is generating 5%, and a GIC that's generating 5%, you are much further ahead on an after-tax basis, because remember, after-tax is what we eat. We don't eat pre-tax, right? After-tax is what we have left in our wallets or purses after we pay taxes. You're substantially further ahead under that scenario. So always keep that in mind. Of course, with a little asterisk, which Sean mentioned earlier, is in non-registered and registered accounts, that doesn't apply.
Because I was about to say, there's your tax foes there are, okay, so now you've got RIF income, for the retirees, right? So you've got RIF income, you've got CPP, we might have OAS in there. If you have some pension, that's all taxed at the highest, right? Interest, pensions, RIFs, all those things are taxed at the highest. So now you're looking for ways of saving on taxes on the non-registered portfolios. And tax-effective construction makes a big difference there.
It's huge. And thinking about tax effective construction hasn't been that relevant for the last 5 years, because, you know, a 1% bond, it really doesn't matter where it is. Like, if you're getting 1%, you know, 50% of one, 20% of one, it really isn't very much. But nowadays, when you're looking at 5%, that's a bit a different story, right? And even if you're looking at bonds versus GICs, once again, bonds, because they change in value, you actually have an opportunity now, and in our portfolios we've done this, to actually buy bonds at discounts. So they may have an interest rate that gets paid out to you at, say, 2 or 3%, but you're buying the bond that comes due in, say, 8 years at $83. What that means is that $17 difference between where you buy the bond and where it matures is a capital gain, right? So once again, even when you're looking at safe investments, you know, air quotes, of a GIC versus a bond, you can end up making substantially more money on your bond because you can split that income into capital gains and interest as opposed to 100% interest.
Right.
All the things that you need to look at, right? And we do have an opportunity that we haven't seen literally for years where you can lock in, you know, 5.5%, 6.5% on a bond, of which a good chunk of that is actually capital gains, right? So once again, about structuring the portfolio.
Yeah, that makes a big difference.
There's no free online software that's going to give you that information.
No. we're getting way too sophisticated for AI to pull that one off successfully.
Yeah.
The other factor that I was going to bring in here, and it's just strictly from the planning standpoint, is rate of return over inflation, right? Because the rate of return in a plan is very important, but the rate of inflation that we plug into a plan is equally important because we're going to tie the spending to that rate of inflation that's going to we're projecting 30, 40 years into the future. We have to plug in that rate of inflation just as much as we have to plug in that rate of return. And we have to kind of dial that in. So we're going to lowball on that rate of return. We're going to go a little on the high side on the average inflation rate. But the real number, or the magic in planning, is what's the ratio? What is the absolute rate of return or the real rate of return after inflation? Right, so if we're dealing with a 4% rate of return on a portfolio and we're plugging in 3% as the inflation rate, it's only a 1% lift over inflation. So we're dealing with something very, very conservative. The other way to look at this is, what if inflation went up or went down based on what's in the plan? That real rate of return is the key. Right? You could say, well, what if inflation goes to 4%? What if it's 4% instead of 3%? Well, that's fine, but then we're also going to factor a 5% overall rate of return because we've got a 1% differential between what's the inflation rate, what's that rate of return. Otherwise, you could be, and I've had clients question me on this. They're like, I want you to give me a rate of return of 3 and an inflation rate of 3. So I said, essentially, they're getting no return. Right. I'm like, okay, I can do that for you. It's not going to be pretty. The plan's going to look pretty nasty.
Are those like the doomsday preppers? Because I'm the kind of person that I overvalue my spending and I always undervalue my savings. So I can be very pleasantly surprised at the end of the year.
Right now, I am encountering slightly more of the pessimistic individuals now than I'm used to seeing. So now people are starting to go the other way, and they're starting to say, what if I have a negative rate of return, right? What if inflation keeps going up and my portfolio can't keep up? All right. We can certainly test that. I'm going to say that's particularly bleak if I'm projecting out 30 years like this, because we're all going to be broke.
Wow.
That's actually 1966 to 1982. The S&P 500 had a 0% return. After inflation, it was a negative 69% rate of return.
Wow.
Because that's during the period of time where inflation went absolutely crazy.
That's right.
Rate.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. The market went sideways and inflation went through the roof.
Yeah.
So negative 69% rate of return.
Oh, yeah.
So good news, your portfolio is flat. Bad news is you went from like steak to, I wouldn't even say hamburger.
Mac and cheese.
You're stockpiling Kraft dinner at Costco.
That's right.
Kraft is much too high.
Good point.
Dollar store.
There you go.
Yes. Yeah. But no, you are right. That's the, you know, like I said, when you're doing conservative planning, you want to make sure it's realistic, right? Like you said, when someone's coming in saying, what happens if I never make any money? Well, under that scenario, it's literally then put it under your pillow because that makes you the same rate of return, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, there's no point, right? So there's all those different things that pop in there. And you know, actually, I think, actually, believe it or not, as a treat to people, I think we might have answered kind of most of our questions and done it in 30 minutes.
I don't even believe you for a second right now. Did we? Let's take a look.
I don't know. I think so.
Did we tackle, we have one here, techniques for managing risk volatility and achieving the sufficient growth to keep a financial plan on track?
I think we looked at a little bit into techniques for managing the risk or the volatility. We did in a way, but once again, that was, you know, part of it, not really talking about the volatility per se, but is just the whole bucketing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why in financial planning, they're always say keep, you know, 3 months worth of, or 4 months, whatever you want to do, savings there, you know, for the rainy day fund. What happens if you lose your job? What happens? You've got to have that, right?
Yeah.
Then you need another bucket. You know, if you're setting aside money, you're going to buy a house in a year or two. Well, you don't go put it in the markets because you have no idea if as my bad sense of humor is, it's either, you know, penthouse or outhouse. And like, that isn't a decision you want for your housing, right?
Yeah.
So those kind of scenarios, right? Yeah. So you want to put that in terms of managing risk and volatility, you know, just to, you know, toot our own horn, but that's something we concentrate on all the time, right? Mm-hmm. As you look over time, markets go through cycles. And, you know, I think one of the best things anyone could do is take an hour of their lives and take a look at market history. Like, you hear us talking about, oh, we're not going to go run after the, you know, buy the marijuana stocks. We've been through there. It's human nature. Like, that's why the markets do the same thing, because humans haven't changed. Fear and greed is always there, right? And so if you go through and look through history, you see certain things that show up. You don't know when the top is. You don't know when the bottom is. But there's sort of signs. You know, valuation. Things can be expensive. So during those periods of time, you want to be taking off risk, right? And during periods of time where there is less risk in the markets, in other words, valuations are less, sentiment is so negative, right? The time you want, you know, the old saying, used as the old adage goes, when they're yelling, you should be selling. And when they're crying, you should be buying, right? Like, that's when you want to buy things. The market is the only thing in the world. If you think of it as a store, how many times do you walk into the store and say, where's the stuff that prices have gone up 35% in the last year? Because I want to be buying that jacket, right? No, you walk in there, you look to the right, you look to the left, you look for the big sign that says discount.
Yeah, clearance.
Right. Clearance. Right? You're like, I can buy this really nice winter jacket because it's, you know, May 8th. And winter's over and they're blowing it out, right? That doesn't happen in the market. You don't look and, you know, it's just a very weird thing, right?
Yeah.
And so as portfolio managers, what Ken and I always concentrate on is looking at the risk, right? How risky is this, right? Like, you see the market goes for a good run. It doesn't go up forever, right? Those are periods of time where we increase cash, right? So how we manage it is we use cash, right? You know, like I was saying, during the period of time when COVID, we started noticing the market look very toppy just before it went in, so we raised 20% cash. Then it started falling, and we started raising more cash. So, you know, during the bottom of COVID, we were 60% cash in our portfolios.
Your cash is king, right? When the markets are falling.
The market turned around. We put some in near the bottom, right? And then we saw the big run up to 2021. And we're looking at things and going, this is silly. We're seeing too much speculation, too much froth, too much risk, not aversion, but the opposite, risk, you know, attraction, people, you know, clamoring to get more risk on. That happens near the top of the market. You never know where the top is. You don't know exactly where the bottom is. But if you can kind of get closish to it and act, then you don't get those big drawdowns. Because in our portfolios, we have we've averaged 1/3 the drawdown in the markets, right? And that's just because we have raised cash when we need to, and they didn't have it. You know, that being said, you also miss out on some of the upside, right? In 2021, when the market was rocking, we didn't do as good as the markets. We told people we're defensive. We don't like taking on risk at this point. 1 year later, market's down 25%. Wasn't I told you so, but we did.
But it was. It wasn't.
But it was. Yeah, the classic, I don't want to tell you, but.
Yeah.
But was that right? You can see this happening, right? And you see it over and over again, right? And the markets, if you look at them and study the markets and study the history, you can mitigate or manage your volatility. And that's what clients want. Clients don't want to be up 30, down 30, right?
That's right.
Because at the end of the day, if you manage the volatility, you end up getting at the same spot, mm-hmm. give or take a little bit, right? But it's much nicer to be able to sleep through it and not have these negative 30s. You know, that would be such a – could you imagine retiring on January of 2000 – I mean, December 31st of 2019 – only to watch COVID come and your nest egg is 1.35% less.
Yeah.
Like you probably don't get to your 66th birthday because you had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Right?
No kidding.
Or other bleak outcomes.
Yeah. Right. So once again, it's like, it's not about hitting the home runs is the, you know, baseball analogy. You want to hit the singles, right?
Yeah.
You want that high rising fastball to the head.
Here's a question, Stephen, a brand new client coming to you. What's the expectation in terms of revisiting a portfolio and making adjustments? How often? Like once a year? Once every 2-3 years?
When you say that, you mean talking to the client about their asset mix?
Yeah.
It should probably for most people be done. Well, actually, you know, as per regulations now, it's done on an annual basis.
Right.
We actually have to contact every single client in our discretionary portfolio on an annual basis and just touch base and make sure the risk and objectives and everything is there. But the one thing, like I said, because we manage money very, very different mm-hmm. from a lot of other advisors, our 80-20 portfolio as an example,
mm-hmm.
which is 80% stocks, 20% bonds, it doesn't stay 80% stocks and bonds through the whole cycle. Like right now we have 20% in cash, right? Because we see risk in the market.
Ah.
If someone came and visited us a year and a half ago, we actually didn't invest the money. We left it in cash because our portfolios were 40, 50% in cash. So we per se don't really follow the classic not even close to buy and hold.
No,
we don't
exactly.
Sit there and say, you know, you're 80% equity and you're going to ride it all the way through. So now you're 70 years old, so you're 60% in equity. And now you're 80 years old, so you're 20% in equity. We pretty much run most of our clients the same way. We have three basic portfolios, an 80-20, 70-30, and a 60-40.
Gotcha.
And those are based on clients' risks, right? But, you know, 2 years ago, the worst performing portfolio I had was a 60-40. Why? Because bonds were overpriced and there was risk in the bonds, and they actually did worse, right? Because of we are so tactical in how we allocate. Our kind of view is everyone kind of wants the same thing. Doesn't matter what age you are. You want a decent return with not a whole lot of volatility.
Totally.
Right? Yeah.
And so that's how we run our portfolios, as opposed to saying, you know, we do have some clients who, you know, have 100% equity portfolios, but guess what? When things go bad, they're not 100% equity. You know, mm-hmm. they had 70% cash last year.
Nice.
Right? So we don't really do that. But the other thing we do as well, Sean, I think this is very important too, is if we have a new client comes to us and they have money, we do not invest all the money instantaneously. We look at things and say, where are we in the market? And like if someone came in today and gave us $1 million, we're not investing that $1 million. No way. We'd go full in on the bonds because we think they're attractive. So the bonds would be there, the cash would be there, and we might take just half of our current equity position because we're not going to just put it in. Because, you know, the day you invest is, once again, kind of like that sequence of returns. You put it all in day one, and then the market drops the next day. Mm-hmm. Not good.
No, exactly.
Right? So you'd want to leg it in and you know, take time to do it. It's not, you know, it's not a sprint.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so when we talk about, you know, having to meet with our clients every year, now is there, we know for the investment side, there's regulations in place. We have to have certain conversations every single year. Is there value to addressing a financial plan every single year, Sean, or do you not see, like, how often do you like to go and revisit with clients on their plans?
Once a year is good, just to especially in the I'm going to say when there's been a big transition. So let's say retirement, revisiting the plan, say annually, just to see, okay, were the expectations on the spending side, are they coming in line with what we were expecting? Was the plan too high, too low? Are they spending more, spending less? But strictly from a planning standpoint, this time of year is perfect around that November mark, November to early December, for two reasons. You can look back over the year, see, okay, how did we spend? And you're kind of starting to line your sights up for the following year, saying, what are we anticipating doing? Are we going to have big summer trips next year? Do we need to do renovations? Do we need to change the roof? Do we want to buy a camper? It could be whatever. Everyone's different, but you're kind of at that. We're at that point now where we've gotten most of the year done, so we can look back and say, okay, this is what our spending was and what it's going to be. The other thing is this is also the time of year where it's like, well, say you were just living off cash. Say you had a lot of money in your bank account and you didn't spend as much as you thought you were going to. Mm-hmm. And this could be a time of year where we say, hey, you know what? Your taxable income is so low this year, maybe we take an extra $10,000 out of your RSP because it's not going to impact you tax-wise. You might not need it, but maybe we just pull it out, saying, okay, this would be a logical time of year to right before year end, and we include this into your taxable income in this year just because it's so low. Flip side is I want to also anticipate large expenses coming up because I know Stephen has to monitor his cash in a portfolio. And it's like if we suddenly need to yank $20,000 out, say, next March or next May, he needs to know that because if you commit all the money in and then suddenly have to yank it right back out again, it could hurt the portfolio. I'm not saying it will, but it could. So let's anticipate those large cash flows and have that communication so it lines up well with the investments.
Yeah. Another thing you throw on there too, Sean, is we've done this with clients too, is let's say you've got your plan and you need that 5% rate of return. Let's just say, and it happens, that you have a really, really good year. And the portfolio is up like 20%. We have said to clients, remember that time we had the conversation and you wanted to go to Hawaii with the family? Like
now's the time.
You know, your $500,000 portfolio is up 20% this year. Yeah. Take the money out and go do it.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, money is only a tool, right? And it's a tool to help you live the life you want and do the things you want. So if you can be in that position where you can hive it off. We've said that to clients, like, just take the money this year. Like, you've had such a good year. Go spend it. That's what it's for. So there's another thing that you were talking about too, Sean. So
I think, I think you're right, Stephen. I think, look at us. It's at like 44, 45 seconds as we're recording this today. And I think you're right. We have covered pretty much all of the questions.
I think we've done good. And actually, looking at our other screen there, looks like Sean just got hung up in Cyberland. So timing was perfect, yeah? or unless Sean has been – unless I think Sean's done a great job. He's actually been sitting in the same pose for about a minute now. So I think that's a sign. Call it.
All right. Well, I think that is a good sign. And it's – you know, I like it when – oh, there he goes. Bye, Sean. Hi, Sean. Welcome back.
Not sure what happened there. Suddenly I got disconnected.
And I had just mentioned, you know, it's nice with you and Stephen chatting back and forth. And today's episode, I think, really highlights like how financial professionals are on the client side at all times. We're on their team, batting for them, rooting for them to have, you know, live their best life. And we're here to hopefully make that happen for them. So.
Let me just interrupt. That probably leads us into what we're going to do. We've had Sean for quite a few episodes, and he's been absolutely outstanding. Mm-hmm. We're actually planning in the near future of bringing in Amanda, our insurance person, because there's a lot of...
She was quite excited about that. She was telling me about
it. There's a lot of things out there for an insurance perspective that can help. When, you know, once again, today we were just talking about putting buckets aside, right? But there's other unforeseen circumstances, right?
Health management side is huge.
Risk management, right? It's like, yeah, great plan, but what happens if husband dies, wife dies, you know, get sick, lose your job? Like, there's all those other things for insurance. And just a little thing out there, which I didn't know. You ready for this? Pet insurance.
We just heard about that.
This is getting huge. Who looks after Fido when you and your wife pass away? Wow. Like, they're actually, people are setting up like trusts and things to cover that.
Yeah.
And Amanda's a good talk about that. She's just an absolute animal fanatic. She loves her kitties and everybody else.
She loves her cats, absolutely.
Yep, but yeah. But she likes dogs too, so she's good from that side. Yeah. But that's just a little leaning. We will just like a little tidbit. But I'll let Ashley close off as I interrupted her.
No, that's okay. Yeah, no, I think that's a good idea to kind of bring forward, because we are planning to bring in more professionals that have a hand in the overall financial plan, because there are, like we say, so many factors. One person can't be the one who knows everything, because there's just too much information out there. So thank you, Stephen, for bringing that up. I do appreciate that. But as I was saying, if anyone has any questions for today's episode or any of our previous episodes, feel free to send them my way. If they're questions for Sean specifically, you can still send them to me. I'm more than happy to send them his way, and he's always more than happy to answer them. My email here is ashley.nichols@nbpcd.com. You can find that email on our website as well. And remember, no question is uneducated. No question is too dumb. Don't ever be afraid to reach out if you think your question is silly. I can almost guarantee you I've probably asked a sillier one. So send us all your questions.
If you're staring at the ceiling worrying, it's worth asking the question.
Absolutely. Exactly. Our thing is, we never want anyone to lose sleep at night. So that's a good
question. Because sometimes the answer, sometimes you think you know the answer and you don't. And what you're thinking makes things much, much worse for yourself, right? It's kind of like stewing over something. We've had questions, perfect example to add a question. Client's like, well, we're in an 80-20 portfolio and I'm worried because we have too much equity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, have you looked at our newsletters? Do you listen to our calls? We're not 80% in equity. We're 50% in equity right now. Oh, I've been worrying about that. It's like, you could have just called.
Exactly. And I have these conversations with some of our clients too, where they say, well, sometimes I just feel like it's a silly question and it's a waste of Stephen's time. And I reiterate, there's no question that's ever a waste of our time. No, that's what we're paid for. Like, you pay us to help you. So like, always ask when in doubt, always ask. You can give it to me first, because I'll be really nice about it. If someone comes back and says, oh, they should know this, I'll be nice. I'll be the nice one. Yeah. So,
you're the filter.
I am. Yes. The gatekeeper. Again, any of our previous podcast episodes, they are available on our website, and that's at www.fiddlejohnstonwmteam.ca. It's under our newsletters, podcasts, and videos tab. Go back and listen to them. Please feel free to send those links to anybody you think who might benefit from any of the information that we give out, friends, family, colleagues, anyone who might be interested. So thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. Have a wonderful day. Sean, Stephen, thanks for joining us again today and taking some time out of your day. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.